Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. William Jelani Cobb, who has written a book, The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. Jelani Cobb is associate professor and chair of history at Spelman College, and he's written a number of really fascinating books, like To the Break of Dawn, a freestyle on the hip-hop aesthetic, and The Devil and Dave Chappelle and other essays. Of course, he lives in Atlanta, where Spelman is, and is joining us from his hotel room in Washington, D.C., where in the day we're speaking together, he'll be speaking in Politics and Prose, but you're hearing him this evening on our program. And Jelani Cobb, welcome. Good to have you back with us on the air.
Thank you.
This is a really interesting book. I was fascinated from the opening quote you had in the book to how you got us through this year of campaigning and more. I just want to start with that. I mean, I just love the... Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, and from the Old Testament. I do like that. This has been really, in many ways, this whole campaign of Barack Obama's and the battle for his presidency has been something like an Old Testament saga to me. It really has. It has had that quality. Has it to you?
Yeah, it did, and it continues to. I think that... When we looked at, the outset of the presidency or the campaign for the presidency, it almost seemed to take on these epic tones and epic hues since really the, maybe the beginning of 2008. And we could see kind of history happening in slow motion, which is, not something that we're accustomed to. And, we reached this moment, almost like this kind of pinnacle moment that could only exist for a brief period of time. But, for the time that it did, it was the perfect vantage point for us to look backward and see who we were, what we, where we came from, and what had allowed us to get to that point. And so that's what I wanted to capture in the book. And even in a way that we don't really think of the presidency now, since we've kind of been bogged in, the minutia of policy, the gripes of congressional conflicts, the ever-present, disillusionment of the electorate, almost no matter who was in office.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to look back at that moment and see what that actually meant.
I was interesting in that in how you kind of throughout the book and weave the kind of the complexity of the history of race in America and all this. I mean, we'll talk more specifically about what you wrote about the Joshua generation, which is a huge piece of the story that you tell. But it's as if the way you perceived it, that the candidacy of Barack Obama involved all the contradictions within race in America and within the complexity of what it means to be black in America and the battles to define that. I mean, it was all embodied in this campaign. And you kind of were trying to unearth that both historically and sociologically, weren't you?
Right. Yeah, it was. Even when we talked about Jeremiah Wright, and the kind of heated tones that conversation tended to take on,
mm-hmm.
But it still was a window into a particular racial reality in the United States. And, we've had these conversations, for decades, for centuries, about what it means to have a constitutional democracy, and at the same time to have people who are not fully citizens of the nation, and those questions were really kind of front and center. And one of the things that I think was unusual about this this election, and one of the things I wanted to also take note of was that we're accustomed to dealing with the big questions in the context of trauma. So we have a particular kind of reflectiveness that comes out of, the assassination of Martin Luther King, or the tumultuous kinds of things that were going on in the 1960s, or the Rodney King riots that happened in 1992. And so, you could go on and on and on. And this time there really wasn't. And it was almost as if there was sweat equity, or what I was calling in the book blood equity, that we had shed enough blood already in order to pay for, to mm-hmm. make a down payment on a future which is more democratic than our past.
You had this great, you raised Jeremiah Wright and your chapter on Jeremiah Wright and the situation with Barack Obama. And I'm going to read this quote because I think this quote is really important. And the quotes you put in this book are just really makes everything kind of bounce out, I think, for the reader. Clearly, you're so well read in history. Well, you should be your historian. But
it's kind of in the job description,
right? That comes with the territory. But you have this quote that I'll read from James Baldwin. The quote is: "The black preacher, since the church was the only civilized institution that was permitted separately to enter, was our first warrior, terrorist, or guerrilla. He said that freedom was real, that we were real. He told us that trouble don't last always. He told us that our children and elders were sacred. When the civilized were spitting on them and hacking them to pieces in the name of God in order to keep on making money."
Right.
That's pretty pretty profound statement in the midst of this.
It is. It is. And it talks about what the prophetic tradition is in black churches. And, you know, there's been this long standing ethic, you know, among the black clergy to call injustice on its face and to push, you know, past the maybe the deference to those people who are in power in pursuit of a higher aim and one that is, you know, divinely sanctioned. And even as we kind of saw the distorted conversation, the decibel on which the conversation was being had about Jeremiah Wright, he still was within that tradition. Like, very few people knew just how much he had done to help the poor, to feed the hungry, you know, as a kind of social ballast, you know, that he'd created in the form of Trinity United Methodist Church. So I think that, you know, that part of the conversation was absent in terms of understanding where he comes from. But at the same time, you know, there were problems, you know, with some of the things that Jeremiah Wright said. Certainly, there's this rule, I think, if anyone talks in public long enough, they will eventually make a fool of themselves, which is why I try to be very moderate about the amount of time I talk in public. But, you know, that rule applied to him as well. And so we saw that when he went to the National Press Club in a ill-advised attempt to salvage his reputation, and that really recognizing the difference between a podium and a pulpit, you know, that one of those is an arena where you are liable to be criticized, and one of them is an arena where people literally say amen to your opinions. And you know, you're really in big trouble if you don't remember which is which.
Well, you point out, I think, very astutely that, and this has different meanings for, I think, white and black America on a number of levels. When you talk about Obama, whose life had not been touched by a black institution, enters into a relationship with a man who is the embodiment of that institution. Mm-hmm. That's fundamental to the core of the relationship between the two men and the breakup and the misunderstanding and understanding of it from every angle in America.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, it's interesting that when we think about President Obama, I think unambiguously identify him as African-American. But when he really moved to the South Side of Chicago as a community organizer, he'd had limited contact with black institutions, per se. He hadn't gone to, you know, a school that was majority black, or he hadn't grown up in a black family, or gone to a church that was, you know, largely black in its membership. And so he's there meeting Jeremiah Wright, who is the head of this extremely influential church, who is a graduate of Howard University, which is a historically black university.
And an Omega.
And an Omega.
Right.
You know, he's a member of Omega Psi Phi, which is, you know, an African-American fraternity. And, you know, so Wright was, you know, kind of steeped in this particular experience. And he was fluent in a particular language that Obama was just learning. Now, I think at this point, Obama is fluent in it as well. But, you know, looking at those two individuals, I think I say in the book, they weren't representing two different worldviews. They were representing two different worlds.
On lots of levels. I mean, I and we'll parse our way through this. But one of the things I think I'm going to throw out right now, and we can come back to it in a bit, is this whole idea that the quote that you have from Anton Gunn later in the book, where you say that where he says Obama is hip hop,
right?
And I mean, this is part of the breaking point of the hip hop Joshua divide,
right? Right. Anton Gunn was one of those people who, you know, I interviewed in the course of working on the book, and he really just made a lot of things clear. He offered, you know, a lot of clarity for some of the things that were going on. And Anton Gunn is a state legislator now, but at the time he was a campaign organizer. Actually, he was the state political director for South Carolina. And, you know, Anton Gunn really was clear. He said that, you know, Obama is hip-hop. And when he meant it, when he said that, he didn't mean that he was a rapper, per se, but he meant that he recognized in him the same kind of attitude, the same kind of approach, the same kind of audacious, you know, swagger, the same kind of laughing in the face of odds that are stacked against you, that are at the cornerstone of the hip-hop music and in some ways the hip-hop generation itself, you know, this generation of people who are born after the Civil Rights Movement's conclusion, or in the midst of and after the Civil Rights Movement's conclusion. So, yeah, and he said, you know, Barack Obama is younger than Russell Simmons, and we don't have any questions about whether or not Russell Simmons represents hip-hop. And so there were lots of young people who were making those kinds of connections, and not just young black people, but lots of young people who were, you know, avid supporters of the president, the now president, who recognized in him that same affinity.
I'm curious how you, one of the things I thought about a lot reading this book was where you think this we're going now with this, what the post-election phase of America with Barack Obama means in terms of the hip-hop generation. But by that I mean, I'm talking about the representatives like what people call the hip-hop intellectuals, like you, like Ta-Nehisi Coates, like Anton Gunn, like people that you mentioned in the book that many people don't know, who are people like Malaika Moses Mitchell, the daughter of Bob Moses, and what they, with what you all are saying, what they are saying now in relation to Obama being president, where you think this new world is taking us. Very curious what you see the leap that is coming towards us.
You know, it's hard to say.
I know it is. I know it's not.
Know, and you know, I'm very humble about making these kinds of predictions, because one of the things that you know, I've insisted that people say, all of us, you know, who are called intellectuals or who are writers or scholars or any people who think for a living, basically, one of the things I always say is that none of us saw this coming. You know, if you'd asked us 2 years ago, or, you know, 2 years before the election, if we thought the country was poised to elect an African-American president, we would have said no, and we would have said no emphatically. You know, the joke that I told was that there were only 4 people in the United States who believed that the country was ready to elect a black president, and they all lived at the same address on the south side of Chicago. And so there's that. But I do think that, you know, we see, you know, a group of people who are not so much, you know, ignorant of the, you know, the history of racism, but also not defined by it either. And so we see, you know, the world in kind of broad terms, and as necessarily so, we have opportunities that you know, preceding generations didn't have, and couldn't have. And so where that will go is anyone's guess, but, you know, I certainly think that the election will be kind of a defining point for that movement.
It really is. I'm really interested. I'm fascinated by where this world is taking us, because it's defining, I think. And this is a little outside the book, but it's not, because I think your book kind of teases us in many ways, because it is defining not just black America, but this whole world of hip hop and the artistry and intellectuality around it is redefining America and redefining the globe.
Right.
You know, this is something is afoot, and Barack Obama is a piece of that, I think.
Right. Well, you know, I just came back from Moscow.
That's right. You were teaching there, right?
Excuse me?
You were teaching there for a couple of
years. Yes, I was teaching African-American history there at Moscow University. And so as a Fulbright scholar, it was a very interesting experience because what I found, you know, was that there were lots of questions. You know, even if I hadn't been teaching the subject that I was teaching, there would still have been questions for, you know, any African-American that they saw, or really very many Americans in general that they saw. And that was, how did this election happen? Like, what they know about the history of America and, you know, American race relations does not, you know, lend itself to the belief, or, you know, that the country was about to make the kind of step that it did, or to kind of, you know, leap into the new era that we're in now. And so there is something interesting that, and I saw, ironically enough, a parallel between this generation of younger African Americans who are, you know, born outside of, you know, Jim Crow, and these young Russians who were born, you know, after Perestroika, you know, and they are kind of looking at, you know, the kind of society that they want to live in, and they don't have the constraints that, you know, previous generations, you know, of Russians did. And so I saw those parallels, too. So I don't think this is just kind of maybe, you know, a national thing, but maybe a just kind of a different thing internationally as well.
We're talking with Dr. William Jelani Cobb, who is the head of the history department at Spelman University, the author of four books. We're talking about his latest book right now, The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. And it, going back to the book itself, there's a couple of interesting connections you made here that I never thought about. And one of those is the connection very early in the book you made between Barack Obama and Du Bois and Dreams of My Father and Souls of Black Folks, which I think is one of the most important books in American social literature. Talk a bit about that and how you made that connection.
Well, you know, it struck me in looking at Obama. One thing I'll have to say is none of us quite knew what to make of him in the society, in the broader context, or, you know, the scholars who were kind of looking at this unfold. And one of the things that we do when we don't understand something is that we find things that we can compare it to. And as I watched, you know, the campaign, Barack Obama reminded me of W.E.B. Du Bois in some ways. You know, one, you know, they both had this experience of race kind of dawning on them in a particular way. Du Bois talks about how he comes to recognize that he's different as a child growing up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And, you know, Barack Obama comes to have that same recognition when he's, you know, looking at the magazine. He's in the library and his mother has him looking at the magazine. He sees this black person who has bleached their skin so they will be lighter. And they both grew up in kind of racially atypical environments. You know, Obama in Hawaii, the only state where people of color are a majority. And Du Bois growing up in Massachusetts in a town where there are so few black people that they almost go unnoticed.
Right.
And so they have racial experiences that are atypical for black people of that era. They both are of mixed ancestry, mixed racial ancestry, and they are exposed to black culture and become deeply steeped in it at some point. You know, Du Bois goes to Nashville to attend Fisk University and, you know, writes about hearing, you know, the spirituals for the first time, and then writes about the experiences he has seeing the black church for the first time. And he goes from being an observer to being a participant observer to being kind of the, you know, chief, you know, scholar, you know, of this experience. And, you know, Barack Obama goes to the south side of Chicago. He goes to a black church for the first time and becomes, you know, deeply enmeshed in, you know, seeing what the struggles of black people in this community are. And, you know, in you know, the course of time actually becomes a representative of that community and then a broader metaphoric kind of representative of that entire struggle that we've seen. And so to me, the comparisons between Obama and Du Bois were very apparent. And I was looking at going, wow, this is very, it, you know, this is very, very significant.
You also in that opening of the book talk about there's a line there that really hit me when you were writing about people saying Barack Obama wasn't really black because he's biracial and and how they attacked Booker in Newark, for the same thing, even though he wasn't biracial in that sense.
Right.
You have this line there that towards the end of that you said Barack Obama is in fact biracial, but then so is Michelle.
Right. Right. it's interesting because technically speaking, yeah, he is of mixed racial parentage. And that's clear. But one of the things that makes this confusing is, were we to simply talk about this as a matter of mixed race, then, you know, there would be about 5 black people in the United States. the vast majority of us have a mixed racial ancestry.
Right.
But that had no bearing on one's capacity to vote, one's capacity to sit wherever you wanted in a train car, on a bus, or in a theater. No, one's capacity to earn a living. Unless you were someone whose black ancestry was not visibly apparent, you were categorized, you all, placed in the same category.
Mm-hmm.
So if we concede, okay, Barack Obama's not the first black president, he's the first biracial president, we then have to say Booker T. Washington, the great biracial leader of the early 20th century.
Frederick Douglass.
Early 20th century. We'd have to say Frederick Douglass, the biracial ex-slave,
Right.
We'd have to say Malcolm X, the person of mixed ancestry, the nationalist of mixed ancestry. we could go through the entire list. I mean, I kind of jokingly said that, this would decimate Black History Month. We have no one we could talk about. And so I don't think that we can change the rules. And that's what I was kind of responding to at that point. When people were trying to figure out who Barack Obama was, I said, well, we can't simply change the rules and say that when someone becomes president, all of a sudden, someone with that exact same, admixture is considered biracial. But if someone, commits a crime or if they're a drug dealer, that person's white parent would be irrelevant. They'd say this person was a black drug dealer, a black criminal.
That's true. They're absolutely right. As my first father-in-law always used to say, and he grew up outside of Augusta, Georgia, and at the knee of his grandmother, who was a slave, and he said that he always had this quote that said, people always say this stuff, but there's no such thing as a purified Negro in the whole United States of America. That he always,
yeah, right.
He always said at every dinner he would say that, the conversation would come up. So I'll never forget Willie Stone and his quotes. They stay with me all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really true. And if nothing else, I think the campaign required that we have that discussion in kind of a blithe way. There were people who were saying, "Oh, well, it seemed to be an insightful thing to say at some point. Oh, well, he's not really black; he's biracial," which was, offensive to lots of black Americans because we were like, since when do you count? I have a white great grandmother, and I'm wondering, what does that mean? Do I get to count her? Do I, retroactively go tell, police officers who may have pulled me over, I know you think that I'm a black person, but I'm actually biracial. What does that mean?
So let me, this is a perfect kind of segue into talking a bit here about the Joshua generation and the issues that I think came up in this campaign and what it laid open for not just black America, but for America in general, I think. Talk as we work our way out of it. I want to talk about some of the specifics of Jesse Jackson and Congressman John Lewis and others and Tavis Smiley. But the core of what you come to learn about what happened to the older generation of leadership that came out of the civil rights movement, why they were
right.
So antagonistic to Barack Obama.
Right. Well, it was interesting because when we talk in America, like, you know, some, just some kind of common parlance. If someone's referred to as a political insider, it has a kind of pejorative air to it, you know, or a slightly tainted association. Oh, he's an insider, meaning that you've cut particular deals and, you know, you can't necessarily be trusted. You're, you know, in this coveted position, you know, that has required that maybe distasteful things be done in order to achieve. And so, but that stigma does not apply to Black Americans, because our struggle has been for so long to get inside. So to refer to someone as a political insider, you know, is almost as a mark of an accomplishment, as a mark of accomplishment and achievement. And what we were grappling with for the first time in 2008, for the first time we grappled with it publicly, were the implications of that kind of status, saying that someone who is, you know, kind of inside, so to speak, is indebted and perhaps beholden to, you know, people other than those whom they purport to lead or those whom they purport to serve. And so in many instances, it wasn't so much a matter of people making the principal decision, you know, during the primaries to support, you know, other candidates. I guess kind of this was most contentious with Hillary Clinton. It was the political indebtedness that required them to do so. And I don't think that, you know, very many Black leaders were accustomed to having that kind of criticism leveled at them when they, you know, began to support other candidates while the majority of their you know, constituents were supporting Barack Obama. We saw that in, you know, the 5th District in Georgia, which is, you know, represented in Congress by John Lewis, the, you know, the venerable civil rights figure who was supporting the Clinton campaign and generated a huge groundswell of criticism as a result of it. You know, people thought, you know, how could this person struggle on behalf of voting rights and, you know, kind of notably be bludgeoned, you know, in pursuit of a Voting Rights Act as a young person and then turn around and, you know, kind of ignore the opportunity to elect the first Black president. And so I think that something that's common, you know, for, you know, white politicians to you know, want to avoid the label of being a political insider was for the first time being applied to Black politicians then.
We're talking with Dr. William Jelani Cobb about his latest book, The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. Mark Steiner. We're talking with Dr. William Jelani Cobb about his latest work, The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. And Dr. Cobb has written three other books, including To the Break of Dawn, a freestyle on the hip-hop aesthetic, and The Devil and Dave Chappelle, and many and other essays. He is chair of the history department at Spelman College and joins us here today. So picking up this, because it was a pretty tense moment in that campaign, these tense moments in the during the campaign when what you referred to earlier happened, whether it was Jesse Jackson using the N-word and talking about castrating Barack Obama as an aside, or right, and the responses you write about from Ludacris and Nas and all, and what former Mayor Young said, Ambassador Young said about him, and all the rest that Bill Clinton was, he said, what Ambassador Young said, Bill Clinton was blacker than Barack Obama or something similar to
right.
That. It was pretty profound stuff going on. This was people really taking umbrage at an upstart. They didn't feel had paid his dues, or with people, as you wrote about, forgetting they were the upstarts.
Right, right.
We were the upstarts.
It was pretty amazing to see, in some instances, the really graceless way that people responded to, you know, then candidate Obama. And it was the way that people respond when they feel threatened by something. And, you know, he appeared to be poised to upset the apple cart, you know, and the traditional way in which black politicians, not all but very many, have operated is that their strength comes from their ability to direct black voters to the white patron of their choice, and with Barack Obama's candidacy, he was able to essentially sidestep the political structure, the Democratic political party structure, or very much of it in the early going. Certainly able to step around the black political structure and take his cause directly to the individuals. And, that represented kind of undercutting people and maybe a change of business model would be required in order for them to maintain any semblance of authority. And so I think that was how people responded. And if I could just kind of say one other thing.
Sure.
I guess the confusion around, what happened, in 2008, we saw again just a few months ago with the candidacy of Arthur Davis in Alabama. I don't think we quite figured out what it was that President Obama did, because he ran a very moderate, middle of the road campaign, and then lost to a white challenger during the Democratic primary in the state of Alabama, mm-hmm. where blacks constitute a huge portion of the electorate, and lost the black vote as an African American who lost the black vote. And I believe that there was kind of this idea that Barack Obama simply took the black vote for granted, and he was able to get the black vote by, being who he was, and he was able to concentrate on, pursuing white voters and swing voters and every other kind of demographic category of voter that we came up with during that year. But I don't think that was the case at all. In actuality, he ignored a lot of black leaders and took his cause directly to black communities and black individuals and kind of the black man or woman on the street, and we had not seen that before, and I think that the implications of that have yet to be seen.
I think that's a pretty profound thought. I mean, because I think that people are wrestling with what Barack Obama did, and it was literally going over the heads and around the quote-unquote established leadership and talking directly to people.
Right.
Talk a bit about what you think that unique breaking point was when the black community began to move away from Hillary Clinton and to Barack Obama.
Well, there were a few moments like that, but I think South Carolina was key.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at South Carolina, one of the kind of important notes in South Carolina's history is that it was the only colony that had a majority black population. So there were actually, early in South Carolina's history, more blacks there than there were whites. And this was, a product of the reason that South Carolina was founded, which was to provide agricultural goods and food for other colonies where sugar was being grown and so on. But the current, legacy of that is that, South Carolina has a very large black population to this day. And when, the South Carolina primary, which was January 26, 2008, when it was about to take place, people saw that as something of a litmus test in terms of how the black vote would go. And it was hard to know how African Americans would respond to Barack Obama. Certainly, there was a canard that we saw in 2008 that just frustrated me to no end, which was the idea that people did not think he was black enough.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw any evidence of that. I never saw any numbers to support that, any polls that said that, they had questions about his racial identity. And it also kind of flew in the face of well-established black voting behavior. For instance, in 2006, African Americans had voted against black candidates in three different races in favor of white candidates, white Democratic candidates, and those were the cases of Lynn Swann, who was running, I believe, for governor in Pennsylvania, the case of Ken Blackwell in Ohio, and also the illustrious senatorial candidate Michael Steele, who who lost in his bid for Maryland, for the Maryland Senate, none of them got over 25% of the black vote. Those are all African Americans, all individuals with two black parents, no unique or exotic name. There's no question. There's nothing you can hang a hook on in terms of questioning their racial identity. And they got very little support from black Americans. So there was that canard that was still going on in South Carolina that people were concerned about his racial identity. And once the campaign in Iowa succeeded, and African Americans saw that there were whites who actually were willing to vote for him, we then saw an increased number of blacks, coming to his side. And I don't think that, I shouldn't say that people were taking cues from white voters necessarily, but people didn't want to waste their vote. They knew that there weren't enough black people in the country to elect him, and that in order to win, he would have to be able to get the votes of a significant number of white voters. He proved that he could do that in Iowa, and that really opened the door for him in South Carolina, and then going on, and the 11 primaries he won in February, which people took to calling the Black History Month massacre, and it was pretty much a fait accompli from there.
I mean, I think that one of the significant numbers in this election for me statistically was seeing that 43% of white Americans voted for Barack Obama.
Right.
That was an amazing number to me.
He had a higher percentage of white voters than John Kerry, and a larger number of white voters than Bill Clinton. It was pretty amazing.
It was amazing. I think that this is the beginning of the long term shift in America. Because I thought about this in terms of our history, and you as a historian, I'm just curious what you think about this as we go back to the convention itself, which I want to talk to you about because I love your observations of Michelle Obama's speech, which I want to get to next. But this idea that what pushes America forward has been a lot of movements over the history of America, often at the helm of that being African Americans and people who have been disenfranchised. And there's, over the history of several hundred years in America, there's been a growing proportion of white Americans who have begun to change. And I think this election said something to me about that.
Right.
That there's a move afoot. Again, this is this kind of unseen move afoot. It's hard to kind of, you can't be prescient about where it's going to take, what's going to happen in the future, but clearly it's an indication something has shifted in America.
Yeah, I believe so. This was not a close, campaign. The Obama candidacy, Obama won more than double the number of electoral votes that John McCain won. He won in North Carolina and Virginia, states where Democrats don't typically win. And lots of white Democratic presidential candidates have not succeeded there. He did better than expected in other, southern states. It really does point to, some ongoing change. We're not quite sure, what all of it means, but it's certainly, when you look at, I believe it was 51 million white Americans who voted for a black presidential candidate, means that something in the society has changed. Although, I've been somewhat hesitant to kind of say hallelujah about that as well, because as I've pointed out to people, I was like the 15th Amendment was ratified in 1870, meaning that which gave African American men the right to vote. There were some blacks who were voting in the North prior to that, but let's just say we only count from 1870 to forward. That means there were 134 years in which black people were voting for presidential candidates that did not look like them.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the one presidential election where whites did, something that we've been doing for one and a third centuries. So, it's a good thing, but it's not, novel.
No, not at all. Not at all. Just indicative of something interesting that I've just been thinking about. That's why I wanted to throw it out there. But one of the things you write about was that I was there also in Denver, and also just about 10 rows back, sitting with the Maryland and Hawaiian delegations, which are right next
door. Okay, right. I remember where they were. Mm-hmm.
And so it was very close, as you were close to watching Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. But you hit something in your book that I thought about at that moment was Michelle Obama and Fannie Lou Hamer and the direct lineage between the two. I was so happy you wrote about that, and I really wanted you to kind of express that a bit, and we can talk about it some.
Well, yeah, when Michelle Obama gave that speech, at the convention, which I thought was an excellent speech.
Yes.
And she came out and was just radiant, in the dress that she was wearing, and the kind of regal bearing that she has, already was amplified, magnified, and it struck me, as a contrast, because here we are in 2008, and we are kind of captivated by this black woman who is speaking, addressing the convention, and it just seemed to be a fitting bookend to look back at 1964, when Fannie Lou Hamer was addressing the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, attempting to get the integrated Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party seated, as opposed to the segregated Mississippi Democrats who had been already seated at the convention. And so it really highlighted, what we saw, and even where, Fannie Lou Hamer says kind of notably and famously, is this America, where, discussing the kind of backward and undemocratic behavior that that blacks have been subject to, and here we have someone who was standing up and explaining who she was and the family that she came from and the close knit familial relationships that were there, and asking politely that people vote for her husband for president. And it was a pretty amazing contrast. I thought that I had to point that out.
It was amazing to me. And just as an aside, Jelani, because when you wrote this one short paragraph, when you write a road led directly from Atlantic City to Denver, and on August 25th, 2008, Michelle Obama etched its roadmap. The charge from her speech accompanied the delegates as they poured out of the building and into the Denver night. Because I was one of those people who was lucky enough to be an 18-year-old in Atlantic City with Fannie Lou Hamer.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And then being an older guy, sitting covering this campaign, and in Denver watching Michelle Obama, and it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I remember the tears were just pouring out of my eyes because I couldn't. Just the whole notion of it blew me away.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty pretty amazing. And even when we think about what Fannie Lou Hamer went through, being sterilized without her permission.
Right.
So she would not have children, be able to have children. Growing up, picking cotton in Mississippi, that is a biography that is at the same time, a metaphor for what this country was at that part, in that point in its history. And, then we have this person who is there, kind of being exalted as this mother of these two, wonderful young children, and this person who comes from Chicago, and we remember that the very large number, in fact the majority of people who make that migration out of Mississippi wind up in Chicago, and so there's like a migration metaphor in there as well. So there are just layers and layers of history that were, I think, on display there.
Layers. You I'm going to read a couple of sentences out of several paragraphs here. So I'm going to focus on one of these, another subject, and one more before we have to close and let you rest up for your evening. That you write, and I'll just go through this. The first black is always a barometer.
Mm-hmm.
If baseball is a microcosm for American society, there's something to be said for this relationship between Robinson and Obama. Obama's Jackie Robinson came in Iowa as millions of people recognized that the parameters had shifted unpredictably and dramatically. And finally, the old unspoken rules still apply. Obama is performing a high wire act with the pitfalls of race surrounding him.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a minute.
There's always, the first person, the first black person who's in a position, and they are kind of watched closely to see, what this, portends for the blacks who will attempt to follow in their footsteps. And it's an unfair position to be in, and, for the kind of stress and pressure that Jackie Robinson was under. Some people attribute that to, hastening his death. He died in his 50s. But yes, we look at Barack or Joe Louis, as kind of the heavyweight champion who had to come after and in some ways cleanse the nation's memory of Jack Johnson, who was on the opposite side, kind of the anti Jackie Robinson figure. And so when people look at Barack Obama, they at least at the outset, they were looking at the potentials of black participation on that level of democracy. I think it's a very familiar experience to very many black people who are kind of saying, mm-hmm. okay, Barack Obama is now, the stand-in person. And some people, for the rest of us, and some people welcome that because, generally speaking, if it's not him, it may be, some person who's in entertainment, and maybe a rapper, and maybe someone who is not necessarily concerned with the broader, social currents of their behavior, and some people welcome that. But I also saw it as being, on some level unfair, even if, he is the representative that we would prefer. It still places this particular kind of microscope, over everything that he does.
So tell me where you think that we go now, and I mean that because in a couple levels. Let me just start with this one, and this is one of the chapters of your book, which is entitled "Where Do We Go From Here." You really poignantly point out that as Barack Obama was becoming president of the United States, three black men were murdered in America.
Right.
By police.
Right.
Killed by police. One of them was Oscar Grant. It's now all in the news at the moment.
Right.
The young man who was killed at the BART station, and Adolph Grimes in New Orleans that you write about. And you write this line, cops go to work each day with a realistic expectation that they may not return home, but black men pay taxes to fund public servants who are disproportionately prone to kill us.
Right.
It seems so pre-Obama, but it's not.
No. And we've seen this. And I say that, at the very end of the book, that he is a president, not an antidote.
Right.
Because, these things were happening the same month that he was inaugurated. And no one wanted to talk about those things because people were so busy, being invested in a counterfeit storyline, of racial transcendence. We've done the impossible. We've buried, the racial, nightmare that has, dogged America, the racial contradiction that's dogged America, and so on. And even, Barack Obama said that we should not expect that. And, one of the things that I've pointed out to people is, the most influential president of the 20th century, in my estimation, was Franklin Roosevelt, and he led the country through the Great Depression and World War II from a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
So, the most effective commander-in-chief that we've had has been someone who had a disability, yet 45 years after his death, the country had to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act because there was still discrimination against people. So there's a limited degree to which I think one person can, represent the transcendence of an entire group. And we'd be wrong to maybe look at it in that light. When we talk about where do we go from here, the answer isn't the kind of short, glib answer is the same places that we have been going. We have to continue to organize. We have to continue to push administrations, including the Obama administration, toward the stances that will move us forward as a society. We have to continue confronting institutional injustice and protesting things like what happened to Oscar Grant. And many other black men that we still see, suffering from these issues now. And so, Obama represents maybe a respite, a rest stop on that road, but he doesn't represent the end of that road.
And he doesn't represent the end of the road. And that's how you kind of conclude the book, I think, very importantly, that you're talking this whole idea that as a historian, that the lopsided nature of history, when freedom opens, something equally horrendous is happening at the same time.
Right.
All the time.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we had this idea, and I think I had it as well, that if such a thing as a black president ever occurred, it would be at a point when all these other things were no longer concerns. Now, we would not have, you know, an unemployment gap among college-educated people that, you know, neatly conforms to race. We would not have, you know, disproportionate, you know, sentencing in the criminal justice system. We would not have an economic gap for people with the same, performance standards and same educational background. And so we look at these things and go, okay, these are barometers of where we are as a society. So, no, we're not going to elect a president. Then all of a sudden, there's a black president that enters that equation. And so we recognize that something we should have known all along, or we should have remembered all along, is that history is asymmetrical. You know, there are incredible leaps forward that in one arena that occur at the same time that we're falling backward in other arenas. And I don't just mean that racially. I mean in the society at large. And so... So, yeah, we were reminded of that again in the course of 2008 and 2009.
And now we're seeing a time as we conclude this, that the conversation that Barack Obama, all the news analysis is saying, may be winning some votes in Congress, but is losing voters. And those voters you're talking about are many of the white voters who voted for him that are always going back and forth between where America is going.
Right.
That's what we're seeing right now.
Right. And, you know, largely on questions of the economy as well. And so it's been interesting that, you know, significant chunks of his agenda have been accomplished or are being accomplished. And at the same time, we're seeing, that really not staunching the bleeding in terms of his loss of support. And ultimately, I think that, you know, it's not, doesn't take a Rhodes Scholar or, you know, a Nobel laureate to figure out that this is about the economy.
It's been really a pleasure. We have been talking with Dr. William Jelani Cobb, chair of the History Department at Spelman College, about his fourth and latest book, The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. Jelani Cobb, thank you so much for sharing all this time with us.
No, thank you for having me on.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New E-Zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.